Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. It's a good day for acts of kindness, maybe even a good laugh. Earlier this week, we talked about the therapeutic power of laughter. We all know it can be contagious. But can it be a good workout, a form of therapy, even a skill? Many happy devotees think yes. Sound there from Canada's first ever National Laughter Championships held in Toronto in November. Inspired in part by the growing popularity of laughter yoga, filmmaker and journalist Albert Nirenberg hosted the first official laughing contest in Montreal back in 2011. He is also director of the 2009 documentary Laughology. And Albert, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
How does competitor laughter work? I'm trying to imagine the different events, the low titter, the belly laugh.
You're kind of there, actually. What's interesting about competitive laughter, when people first hear the idea, they think that's insane or impossible. And what's interesting is we do these things for 90 minutes. So it's a full sport. Some of the laughs are individual solo laughs. Like, for example, you might take a group of people and say, well, who has the best diabolical laugh? But then we have face-to-face laughing combat, which is more the duel. And that is also very thrilling.
How do people actually get judged, though? You know, what makes a great laughing champion?
Well, this is a key thing in the maturation, I would say, of laughing championships. And at first, we were just like, well, whoever sort of the audience likes wins. But now we judge strictly on contagiousness. So basically, how contagious is your laugh to the audience? And that's important because otherwise, you might just have like the loudest, biggest person winning all the time. And the second thing is we have both judges, and the judges are there kind of to interpret audience reaction, but also you can essentially win and lose rounds. That's what's kind of maybe new about it, which is that you might have the best diabolical laugh, which sort of saves you from being eliminated in that round, and then it's a last man standing format where you eventually arrive at the greatest laugher in that country. So there are new kind of challenges where you really have to be an all-round great laugher if you're going to succeed and win the championship.
Give me an example of a challenge. I don't understand what you mean there.
Okay, well, diabolical would be a challenge. It usually begins with a sentence. So there's a sentence where somebody says something. Then they issue like their first laugh, which usually is not so big. Like it might be, New Hampshire is the greatest state in the world. And then I do my first laugh, but then that causes me to laugh contagiously at my second laugh. Yes, New Hampshire will soon rule the world. And then the third laugh is the most insane, where you go, soon it will be live free or die for everybody. No one can stop New Hampshire. And you can usually have an accident, like a seizure or fall off your chair. Like that.
Does that ever happen?
Yes. I was told very clearly I must get insurance for future events because of the risk of injury.
Wow.
Well, there's a reason for that. When people laugh very hard, they can experience something called laughter paralysis, where they can fall over. So it is a very real danger.
Well, it seems to me there's a little bit of a paradox, isn't there, between this kind of authentic, liberating goals of laughter and the paradigm of competition. Do those two ever bump into each other?
Yes. That's how it looks at first glance, but I would say that there really is no contradiction. Basically, laughter has been hacked, is the best way to explain it. It happened in 1995 with the invention of laughter yoga, as they figured out most people in our culture require jokes, or they require, you know, seeing a funny movie to laugh. And so you have to wait a long time often to have a good laugh. What laughter yoga demonstrated is that you can provoke yourself into laughter with a series of behaviors. They're basically outward exhalation on the laugh sound while making eye contact. Those are the three triggers. If you do those things, you will actually laugh authentically. We want laughter to be more common. And so that's why we're elevating into a sport.
That's your read of the benefits. What has scientific research been able to tell us about the origins, I guess, the biological purpose of laughter?
Well, it's almost too much to contemplate. But I would say what's important to know is that serious laughter research only starts, you know, in the last 20 years, 15 years. Before that, they really saw laughter as like a nervous tick, you know, a kind of bizarre, unexplainable behavior that was trivial in nature. Now the recognition is that laughter on the health side can really be a hedge against heart disease, that even anticipating laughter apparently strengthens the immune system. But I think there's an enormous distinction, and a significant one, between laughter and humor. Humor is a cognitive process. It's joking. It's intellectual, ultimately. Laughter is very primordial and simple, and it's something universal.
Well, let's hear from some of your laugh-leets, as I guess they're called. Joining us now on the line is the American laughing champion, Julie Ostro. Welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia.
And the woman with the sexiest laugh in Canada, Katie Solomon. Katie, good to talk with you as well.
Thank you for having me. How are you?
Very well. Katie, I'm curious, what makes a sexy laugh?
I've been told it's something where you are feeling sexy, where you can communicate that, but also it's a laugh that creates sexy thoughts in the listener.
Can you do it on cue?
I can.
Okay, well, I'm kind of embarrassed, and I wonder if the FCC will even let us put that on the air, actually. How about you, Julie? You're the American Laughter Champion. What's your specialty?
I realized that when I was up on stage and laughing to the point where I couldn't control it anymore, kind of tied into what Albert was saying about the laughter paralysis, I was, I guess, a victim, you could say, or was afflicted by the contagiousness of my own laughter. So it was just this natural laugh that I've had all my life, where throughout my life I was either condemned or praised for my laugh, because it's kind of kooky.
Could we hear it?
Sure. That's what it's about, right?
Oh my goodness. Well, judging from everyone in the studio behind the wall here, that's a really contagious laugh, and it really worked on us. But I'm curious about, you know, going from the woman who has the great laugh to ending up in the competing laughing world. How do you get there? Did you train?
Well, I am a laughter yoga leader myself, but how I got involved in the competition was by pure chance, because the American Laughing Championship was held at the AATA, Humor Association, conference in San Diego in April. And actually, Albert had posted the day before the conference. He said, hey, where are all the women in this competition? And I didn't even think, Virginia. I just said, here I am. He said, okay, you're in.
Albert mentioned a little bit about laughter yoga. Just watching videos of it, that's one of those things that it just makes me crack up. It's so wonderfully contagious. But can you articulate for us how laughter yoga is different from other and maybe, I guess, more well-known yoga traditions?
That's a really good question, because in a lot of circles, I find myself talking about laughter therapy as opposed to laughter yoga. What I was trained to, what I was told was that yoga means breath and connection. So I tell my group, you know what, you don't need a yoga mat. What you're wearing, the jeans and the t-shirt, just fine. We're not going to be doing a downward dog, and no one's going to laugh at you doing that. But yoga means breath, and it means connection. So through the laughter exercises, we connect with our breath, with ourselves, and with other people. Does that answer your question, Virginia?
Yeah, it does. Okay. And I'm interested because you do this for your health. You do it, I'm guessing, for your spiritual well-being. But I'm wondering if you ever get hired to do laugh tracks or voiceovers or that kind of thing.
Yes, I am. I'm for hire, for everyone who's listening to that. And yes, I actually was approached by someone. I was the roving laugher for a golf fundraiser. So I took the golf cart, rode around with my trophy, and had laugh-offs with people. And there was a gentleman there who said, we need to hire you for commercials. So, yeah, I'm open to that.
How about you, Katie? Do you get hired to do laughing professionally?
Well, I'm also open for hire.
So yeah, I actually entered this competition on a fluke. I didn't know that I would become like the first runner-up for the cup. I didn't even think I would make it past the first round. So it was really awesome for me.
Julie and Albert might have an opinion on this. There are many proponents of laughter yoga that say it has all sorts of healing effects, from treating depression and alcoholism, increasing pain tolerance. We heard you earlier say, Albert, that it's good for the heart. Now, any kind of data behind these claims, or at this point, is it still anecdotal?
There's an interesting debate all around those issues. The reason why you're actually hearing so much noise from my line, I'm guessing, is I'm actually in a drug rehab center right now where we do laughter therapy. What's interesting about laughter is that it's almost like you can pick up a study and then you can apply it, and you often will be amazed by the results. A Stanford study showed that laughter and cocaine produce dopamine in the brain in very similar ways. So we thought, okay, well, that's interesting. Famously, cocaine addicts are often kind of depressed and sad when they come off their drug. And we basically did laughter yoga type exercises, and we found it to be true that the addicts would report anecdotally, because we haven't done formal research, that it was relieving of the kind of really unpleasant moods that come with coming off of a drug. I should, though, point out that there's actually a well-publicized debate, because there is some feeling among some scientists that there is some exaggeration. There are people in the laughter business who will say laughter can cure cancer, it can stop you from getting colds, it can help you overcome, you know, many, many serious chronic illnesses. The people who talk about laughter and cancer, I think they falsely report that laughter might be curing people of cancer. I really doubt that that would be true. But here's a very interesting thing. There is now evidence that one of the things that laughter does when you have, let's say, a good, healthy laughing fit, is it moves you in the part of the brain, the limbic system, that has no sense of time. Mm-hmm. So if you're living a life, for example, with a serious cancer diagnosis where you feel like you're running out of time and maybe you're going to die soon, if you sit with your friends and you have a good laugh, for that moment you are completely free of time. You're living forever, so to speak. That itself might be therapeutic and at least release you from the horrible stress of facing down a chronic illness.
For the novice, for us sitting here listening to you and Julie and Katie and, you know, catching the infectious laughter, how do we start? How do we start to cultivate laughter inside of our own lives?
There's a really simple thing, way to do this. Next time you have an opportunity to laugh, like a joke, or you hear something funny, I just say, go for it. Laugh really hard. And it actually works. If you just think, like, next time I'm going to laugh, I'm going to let go. That's the first thing I recommend people do. But I also really recommend trying laughter yoga or learning some of these new laughter techniques. The laughter yoga, they advertise that their technique is life-changing. And what's weird about that is that I would say it's true. I think I was a very serious journalist guy before I got into the laughter movement, and now I'm a ridiculous buffoon. It's not for everybody. There's a kooky, crazy side. But I would really say, yes, it really can be life-changing.
Albert Nirenberg, a one-time serious journalist and filmmaker now, and originator of Competitive Laughing. Thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And also thanks to you, Julie Ostro, American Laughing Champion.
Thank you, Virginia.
And Katie Solomon, the woman with Canada's sexiest laugh. A great pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you so much.
There's much more on laughter yoga, including the film Laughology. You'll find links at wordofmouthradio.org.
And in the words of that immortal bard, Samuel J. Snodgrass, as he was about to be led to the guillotine, make him laugh, make him laugh. Don't you know everyone wants to laugh? My dad said be an actor, my son, but be a comical one. They'll be standing in lines for those old honky-tonk monkey shines. Now you could study Shakespeare and be quite elite, and you could charm the critics and have nothing to eat. Just slip on a banana peel, the world's at your feet. Make them laugh, make them laugh, make them laugh.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. More than a third of the world's population does not have access to clean, safe toilets. It is a humanitarian and global health hazard that the World Bank estimates drains $260 billion off the global economy each year. The Gates Foundation challenged engineers to develop commodes that are clean, cheap, and don't require electricity, a sewage system, or even water. But as with any new product, you have to test it. That's where John Keller comes in. He's principal engineer at Maximum Performance. It's a company that tests toilet efficiency using its own patented material.
We came along right after, I guess you'd say, the turn of the century, and decided that there was a need for someone to measure actual flush performance to give a consumer or an architect, for example, the information needed to make a selection. Nobody wants to put in a product like this and then be dissatisfied a month later and not know what to do.
But in order to test a toilet, you have to have, material to test. So that's something else your company did, correct?
Yes, the development of a soybean paste test media, we call it, began in around 2001, 2002.
You say test media, what you're making is fake feces, correct?
Yep.
So, you know, people say they don't want to know how the sausage is made, but I actually am curious about this because it is actually made with a sausage extruder. How do you make fake poop?
Well, without going into a lot of detail, the fake material is purchased in bulk. It's soybean paste. It's a food product. First of all, it's reconstituted to make sure it meets the specifications that we have developed for this material. That is adding water or adding something to dry it, whatever. Then it's extruded through a sausage extruder and then encased in a latex material that makes it very flexible and realistic, I guess you'd say, and reusable for testing purposes.
You began doing this, you said, in 2001, 2002. I'm pretty curious about how you got started, you know, thinking, what is the demonstrable need for fake feces?
Well, most of the testing up to that point in time had been done using such things as pieces of plastic or sponges or paper wads, or even certain kinds of flexible toys, none of which were really anything like real-world demand upon a toilet.
I guess one obvious question that comes up is, like, why don't you use the real thing to test?
Oh, my gosh. Now you have variability that would be very significant and would probably involve a great many more sanitation and health problems just associated with the testing.
What are some of the factors that go into grading a toilet?
Well, what we do is we basically test toilets to their point of failure. So you know that a toilet that is able to flush, let's say, 1,000 grams, which is about 35 ounces of material, three times what the normal person's maximum would ever be, is a fairly substantial flusher. What we do is we start testing a toilet at 350 grams, which is the real minimum threshold for any toilet to perform, beginning at 350, then at 400, then at 500, then at 600, and so forth, up to 1,000 grams. If it fails to flush everything out, let's say, at 800 grams, and the previous test was at 600, that means it gets a score of 600. So we test these toilets to failure.
John Keller, Principal Engineer of Maximum Performance, thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
You can find a link to the Maximum Performance website where there are tips for things to consider before purchasing a toilet. That link is at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up after the break, witnessing a skiing tradition that dates back 5,000 years. Elk hunting on the slopes of Central Asia. That's when Word of Mouth continues. Stay with us.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. As the first snows fall, weekend warriors from all over New England will pack up the car, strap the skis to the roof, and hit the slopes for a fairly expensive getaway. But in some places, skiing is a strategy for staying alive. Mark Jenkins, a contributing writer for National Geographic, traveled to the northernmost fringe of Western China, where skiing was invented many millennia ago. He spoke with the people who carry on the earliest skiing traditions, using the same resources and methods as their ancestors. Mark Jenkins' article is called On the Trail with the First Skiers and joins us now on the line. Mark, great to have you with us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Where the first skiers came from is a matter of some debate. So could you fill us in first on that discussion and competing evidence of first humans on skis?
Sure. Well, it all comes from snowy countries, as you would expect. The competitors are Norway, Finland, Sweden, Russia, and China. And China is the most recent to start to claim that they were the first to ski. They have now found petroglyphs of skiers chasing ibex in northern Altai in China that date to 3,000 to 5,000 years old. But of course, the Russians have found an actual ski tip that is 8,000 years old. So there's kind of a bit of a battle of who was the first to ski. My sense of it is that it might have been a simultaneous adventure all across the North Country because they learned to ski to hunt.
You went to this remote hamlet. Okoram, is that how we say
it? Okoram, yeah.
Okoram, yep. Mountains in northwestern China, Central Asia, really. We're lucky enough to witness people using the age-old process of making skis. Can you tell us about the process?
Sure. It was extraordinarily simple in some ways. I mean, they all carry an axe, and they just ski out. You've got probably 5 feet of powder. It's incredibly light snow. It's champagne powder. This is a continental climate, so there's very little precipitation. Ski out. Find a tree, a red spruce. They'll spend all morning looking for the straightest tree with the straightest grain. They'll cut it down. They'll make a chunk that's about 7 feet long. They'll split that in half. It's so cold, it's usually 20 to 40 below zero every day, that they just score the trunk down the middle, and with a swing of the axe, they split the tree in half. And then they basically axe it down to these two kind of look 2x4 looking things. They carry it back to their shed, their horse barn, and then they whittle it down with an axe, put it in a pot to bend, to heat up the tips and bend them, put the bent tips in a jig, hold it for about 10 days like that, and then they nail horsehair the full length of the bottom of the ski, so it glides forward very easily, but catches. It's kind of like the fur of a cat, you know, if you run your hand one way, if you run your hand the other way. And that's how they're able to climb up and down mountains so easily. They don't use wax on the bottom. It's horsehair.
How about the technique of actually operating the skis? One pole, you use kind of like a rudder. How did they do that? How fast can you go and how much control would you have?
That's a good question. They have far more control than you would imagine. Now, the problem, again, is that the snow is so light that I was on telemark skis, and I had this standard two-pole system. And even with a fairly large basket, for those in New Hampshire, you call a powder basket on the end of your pole, it would sink straight down to your hands in the snow. The tayak, or the pole that they have, is about 6 to 8 feet long. So they use that to push themselves forward, and when they're going downhill, they use it as a rudder. They put it kind of along the side and drop the tail in with their hands, and that's the way they're able to turn. Now, the bindings are incredibly simple. They are just an X strap of leather, and there's four holes drilled into the ski, and then they have leather straps coming up, and they just put a snow boot in there. So they're not tight, and your heel can slide off very easily. So it takes a lot of skill. I got on these skis and tried to do what they can do, and obviously I need several generations of practice to be able to do it. They even jump these skis.
There's a chart here of comparing different skis from different eras. These look, I guess, a little shorter, a little thicker, maybe more like telemark skis. The people that live in this region also have an interesting lineage, a kind of mix, almost stuck in the middle of several different countries and cultures. Can you tell us a little bit about the people who live there?
Sure. Although we were in China, the tribes people we were with are Tuvans. And they feel like they're direct descendants of Genghis Khan. In fact, when you go into everyone's home, there's a not a portrait, obviously, a picture of Genghis Khan, and they even shave the kid's head with just this little black tuft of hair. So they see themselves as descendants of Genghis Khan. They are a Siberian/Mongolian people, largely pastoralists. They raise horses and they eat horses. And during the winter, they hunt on skis. They hunt elk.
Which language do they speak?
They speak Tuvan, which is this kind of, it's actually a variation of Turkish, which is remarkable.
Like the throat singers, the Tuvan throat singers?
That's right. That's right. These are the same people, the throat singers. I tried to get some of them, when we were out on this long, multiple-day elk hunt, I tried to get some of them to throat sing, and they couldn't do it, but they did put on some Tuvan rap for me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Now, you have to imagine the scene here, because the snow is about 5 feet deep, and what they've done is they've cut down actual trees and drag them down. These are dead trees, obviously, and made a bonfire that would make the Boy Scouts proud. I mean, it burned a hole 4 feet down to the ground. And so we're kind of in this enclosed wall, the snow melting, and they're singing songs, and then suddenly they get kind of bored with their traditional songs and just put on a smartphone with a couple of little speakers. And now we're skiing. We just crossed elk tracks. We've crossed wolf tracks. And these guys are incredibly tough. I mean, they just put an army blanket over them and slept through the night. They all pile in one pile, and it was literally 40 below. I had my Everest sleeping bag with me.
Wow. Tell us about that hunt, which was actually more of a trekking expedition, because I guess hunting is really restricted in China.
Hunting's illegal and owning a firearm is illegal, but that doesn't really matter because they have a different tradition there.
Huh.
We set out, half a dozen of us. We crossed elk tracks several times, and on the third day, we actually came in contact with two bulls, which obviously ran off, and so we tracked those bulls. Now, when they got close enough, they saw them down in the valley. They just jump onto their skis and go straight down. I mean, none of this big slalom turns and things like that. They basically ski, 30 miles an hour straight down. And the amazing part is they're going to lasso these elk.
So what? On the skis?
On the skis. You're skiing down, and they've got a rawhide lasso. Imagine this. This is a cowboy skier, right? And this loop in the lasso has to go over the antlers of an elk. So it's about 6 to 8 feet wide, the loop, and they're screaming. Then they fall backwards and catch the elk, and their skis are perpendicular to the elk. And, of course, the elk, remember, it's such light snow that the elk are almost already swimming.
Mm-hmm.
They're swimming in the snow, and they start to fight. They struggle against the rope. The skiers, the Tuvan skiers, are actually kind of just dragged through the snow, and this will go on for 2 or 3 hours until the elk is exhausted. It's kind of old men in the sea sort of thing.
What a scene.
It's fantastic, yeah. And it's been going on for thousands of years. No matter what you believe, where the oldest skiing and ski culture is, it's certainly 3,000 to 4,000 years old, the same technique. But they can't kill the animals. So they actually took myself and the photographer out just to show them that they still had all these skills and they still could do this.
Well, you and the photographer were there. Do you think if you hadn't been there, they would have killed the elk?
Yeah, it's hard to question. I think they may have, although they have a very successful herd of horses, and they eat horse meat all the time. That's what we survived on, was horse meat. So I don't know if they need the meat that much, but they love the hunt.
I think, Mark, many of us have seen those photographs of mountains, glacial basins, where snow and ice has receded, ascribed to climate change.
Right.
Has that changed snow levels or anything about the lifestyle of the people that you saw?
It has. The Altai, like all places, I was on Everest last year, it's also lost an enormous amount of snow. Same here. This is the first time in the last 4 years that they've been able to ski well enough to actually track elk. Formerly, 50 years ago, I interviewed a lot of the old guys who were 75, 80. You know, every winter there was 5, 6, 7 feet of snow. So the elk are kind of stranded. They're just, cutting troughs. And so hunting elk was not that difficult. Now, unless you have a heavy snow year, you can't hunt them at all because they'll just leave.
Mark Jenkins, contributing writer for National Geographic. He wrote the article On the Trail with the First Skiers for this month's issue. You'll find a link to read the article and see a slideshow of some of the spectacular photos, including those of a lassoed elk. There's also video of the skiers in action. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Mark, thanks again.
My pleasure, Virginia.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Tumbleweeds rolling? Must be a Western. The cinematic signal of High Plains desolation has an even more pernicious side. It's an invasive species known as Russian thistle, and it's wreaking havoc across the United States. George Johnson is a science writer based in Santa Fe and a regular contributor to National Geographic, where he wrote about fighting the tumbleweed menace in his own backyard. The article is called The Weed That Won the West. And George, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
So, Russian thistle, the tumbleweed we see rolling around in Westerns, why should we be worried about this seemingly innocuous, dead-looking plant?
Well, it's just invasive. It takes over any place where you have disturbed soil or just, neglected roadways or vacant lots. I mean, they're everywhere out here. And as verified by the U.S. Department of Agriculture's plant database, Russian thistle is growing in every state of the United States except Florida and Alaska.
I guess what we read in your chronicle of the battle is that it's pretty difficult to kill these.
Oh, they're evil, unkillable, they're just horrible. They're like some alien invasion. And it's so funny because, this is the iconic view of the American West, the tumbleweed, loping across the road. And then it turns out it's an invasive species from Siberia.
How did it get here to the United States?
Oh, it's probably a few seeds on a Ukrainian immigrant sock. basically what they think they know is sometime in the late 19th century in South Dakota, there were some Ukrainian farmers who imported some flaxseed grain from the home country, and they believe that that was contaminated with some Russian thistle seeds, and this is where it got its start. So that was ground zero, and before long it was spreading to the adjacent states and pretty much the full West, and it had reached California and then headed east, and it's everywhere.
What is it about the plant that makes it difficult to kill and quick to spread?
Well, you imagine this plant evolved in Siberia, so it's one of the harshest places on Earth where anything could grow. So it comes to any place else and it's like retiring to Florida. So it's just it thrives, and it's been streamlined by evolution so that most of its energy goes into producing seeds and thorns to protect them and stalks that curve over, so when the plant dies every year and the wind hits it, it rolls in a ball for miles and miles, spreading its seeds.
Uh-huh. So it's just throwing off seed as it's loping along, huh?
Oh, as many as 250,000 seeds for a large tumbleweed. They can be, the size of a Volkswagen bug.
So, George, this pernicious weed, you became pretty invested, may I even say a little obsessed, with killing Russian thistle on your own property.
Totally obsessed.
Sounded like you started to go a little nutty.
it was a few years ago, and my wife at the time, no longer married, but we bought a couple of acres west of Santa Fe for her to keep her horses. And we noticed when we bought it, a few tumbleweed skeletons lying around. But you can't avoid that. They're everywhere. And, we figured, well, of course you're going to have tumbleweeds if you buy land in the West. And then the spring came and they started sprouting everywhere, thousands, tens of thousands of these. They start out looking very pretty. They're these little blue-green kind of star-like plants. And then by that time, I'd already fought enough of them back at the house in Santa Fe that I knew what they looked like. And I just thought, oh, here it comes. And so they come in waves. And the best thing you can do is to try to kill them before they get big enough to set seed.
So they certainly sound troublesome, but you know that they're dangerous. What's the danger of the tumbleweed?
Well, one of the things is fire hazards. They clump up against fences or in irrigation ditches, and all it takes is a cigarette thrown out of a car, and they can just, they burn with a great ferocity because there's so much air in them. Once they're dead and they're these skeletons, there's huge amounts of air, so it's more air between the branches than plant material, so they just explode into flames.
So you are one man fighting the menace. How about on the state or municipal level, are state governments doing something about trying to stop it?
Mostly, I think people have kind of given up. You have to learn to live with it at some point. I mean, municipal governments will clean out you know, irrigation channels and places where they've piled up. And the funny thing is you'll see them going out there and mowing down all these weeds after they've already gone to seed. So, you know, it's a hopeless Sisyphean task.
And I guess some towns actually use them as tourist attractions.
You know, I couldn't believe it. Even my own hometown, Albuquerque, every winter now they put up a giant tumbleweed snowman that looms menacingly over the interstate. And I just got an email from a reader down there that said, well, the tumbleweed snowman is back again. So I don't know. To me, that's kind of sick to celebrate these things, but maybe it's healthy just to acquiesce to the inevitable.
So your house, George, is the one on the block under the plastic bubble now?
No, actually, it was a matter of just planting other things, you know, like grama grass and things that grow well in dry climates. And it's a great philosophical question about a weed. Is a weed, you know, is there something inherent about weediness, or is it in the eye of the beholder?
I'd love to hear you go even further with that idea about weeds, because your research about weeds worked its way into your latest book, and it's called The Cancer Chronicles. And this is about your wife's, your then-wife's battle against uterine cancer. I'm curious how you bridge those two things.
Yes, it was the time when we bought this land, it was several years after she'd been diagnosed with a stage 4 metastatic cancer. And it was one, she was very, you know, the survival rates were just frighteningly low, but she survived it. And we bought this land for horses, and as I was out there fighting the weeds, I just kept thinking that, you know, if weeds is a metaphor for cancer, you know, in a cancer, a cell will suddenly start evolving on its own, and it'll outcompete the other cells in the body, and it'll grow into this kind of quasi-creature, you know, outcompeting the healthy cells and just thriving inside the ecosystem of your body, but, of course, to its great detriment. And that seemed, you know, very much to my metaphorical mind, like tumbleweeds. And another metaphor struck me when I was using these herbicides. You know, I'm very careful when using these things, and I look up and see how they work. And there's this herbicide called triclopyr, and I thought of it as chemotherapy, killing the cancer. But, you know, it just, I mean, of course, cancer was just really obsessing me as much as weeds, and I was just starting to write the Cancer Chronicles and ended up using that as a metaphor in my book.
Well, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
George Johnson is a science writer based in Santa Fe. He wrote The Weed That Won the West about the tumbleweed invasion. It's in this month's National Geographic. You'll find a link to read it and see a slideshow of some of the fantastic photos that went with the article at wordofmouthradio.org, along with more information on George's book, The Cancer Chronicles, Unlocking Medicine's Deepest Mystery. It's all at wordofmouthradio.org. And we'll be back with more Word of Mouth after a break.
Here on the range we belong, drifting along with a tumbling tumbleweed.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Sebastian Thrun, the man behind perhaps the most disruptive idea to hit higher education, massive open online courses, or more commonly MOOCs, has decided to jack it in. While some traditional educators may be saying, I told you so, proponents of free online education are worried about what his shift means for the model's future. Rebecca Schumann is education columnist for Slate and adjunct professor at the University of Missouri. She wrote about Sebastian Thrun, the acknowledged godfather of MOOCs, and his move away. Rebecca, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Pretty big gear change for Thrun. I guess you pronounce his name differently. But he went from online education evangelist to moving his company, Udacity, to the corporate training world because of what he called a lousy product. Bring us up to speed, would you?
Well, according to this very sort of lengthy profile of him in Fast Company magazine, which is basically the Pravda of the Silicon Valley set, as blogger Mike Caulfield puts it. With apologies to Pravda. A few years ago, he was giving TED Talks and going on TV very confidently saying that soon there would only be 10 content providers of higher education left in the world. and one of them would be Udacity. But when it was time to use the Udacity courses in an actual college environment with actual college students, it failed disastrously. The San Jose State University math program did a pilot program where one class of students took an in-person math course and another class of students took a MOOC for very, very low cost, but they did pay for it. And 74% of the in-person students passed and 51% of the MOOC students passed. Mm. And that was simply just not good enough for San Jose State. So the official language is that they're putting their project with Udacity on hold, but we don't. It may be an indefinite hold. And so Tawun was not happy with these figures, but his reaction is what upset a lot of people in the higher education community, because what he said was, well, these students are not a good fit for this product.
Mm, so and he's blaming the students.
I don't know whether he all is completely blaming the students, but in this article, it seemed as if he were blaming the students. And he was blaming them specifically for being lower income and for coming from what he put as difficult neighborhoods with few, if any, access to computers and challenges in their lives.
Wasn't that supposed to be the target demographic for free online courses?
Absolutely, it was, according especially to Tom Friedman, who's basically been this sort of very loud mouthpiece for MOOCs for the last several years. He has a MOOC column in the New York Times, what appears to be every few months.
What would you, as an education columnist who's looked at this model, see as a fundamental issue with MOOCs? Is it with MOOCs, or is this about Sebastian, and I'm going to copycat you and say Tawun's overreach? What's really at issue here, the model or the leader of this model?
Oh, I don't really have anything against him at all. He seems like a very interesting person, and I think that he was trying to do something, you know, new for the world. I think it's the model, because all MOOCs are is a dressed-up version of the correspondence course, which has been, you know, attempting to take people's money and failing to educate them for hundreds of years. So the first reason that MOOCs are ineffective is that they replicate the most ineffective form of college teaching, which is the large lecture. I don't know if you have been to a college lately and been to a lecture hall. Well, it's a new world now with technology. What you will see when a professor is giving a lecture now is texting, Facebook, Snapchat, games. They are doing anything but paying attention to the lecture. This may not be the case at the most privileged institutions like Harvard, but at the institutions where the vast majority of Americans get their bachelor's degree, large lectures are basically something you go sit in and resent and not pay attention. Mm. The real learning, if there is any at all, in a large lecture class takes place during discussion section, which happens with qualified instructors and teaching assistants. And MOOCs do not have those. What MOOCs have instead are sort of discussion leaders that are other students, or they're never paid, they're volunteer. It's the inmates running the prison.
Hmm.
And so they're simply an ineffective model because there is no interaction between the professor and the students.
Harvard, MIT, Yale, they all have these online free course models. Is that happening with all of them, or was it just how this San Jose University / Udacity collaboration was managed, to your mind?
It's hard to tell because all of these elite institutions that have MOOCs do not offer credit for them at their own institution. If you take a Harvard MOOC as a Harvard student, you're doing it for fun.
So
they wouldn't dream of offering credit for their own MOOCs. And so the Udacity partnership was one of the first instances where credit was actually given for a MOOC, and it was a disaster.
Is your thought then that this model is bad for higher education, or does this current model maybe just need some adjusting?
It is unequivocally bad for higher education for several reasons. It furthers the sort of corporatization of the higher education model. It also is very bad for the exchange of ideas, because if Sebastian Tawun's dream had really come through and there were 10 providers of higher education in the world, that's basically like one super professor per subject. And is it really safe to have one person with that person's ideas be the only person disseminating knowledge on a specific subject? I can think of a place where that happens, and that's North Korea. So pedagogically, it's irresponsible and dangerous, but mostly it just doesn't teach students because, you know, I'm a professor. I'm in there with students every day, and I know what it takes to teach them. It takes an interaction of a minimum of four moves where you say something to the students, they say something back to you in reaction to what you said, you say something in reaction to that, and then they react again. And that's sort of the bare minimum that it takes to learn anything.
Well, let's make a distinction here, however, between these MOOC courses, these massive, you know, sometimes tens of thousands of students, free courses, and the growth of online education. Here in New Hampshire, we have a very quickly, in fact, one of the most fast-growing schools in the country, Southern New Hampshire University, or SNU, which also does online courses that are focused on being smaller. Is that the key, or what is the distinction there?
There is a very big distinction between MOOCs and online education. Mm-hmm. An online course that you matriculate for at a university such as the University of New Hampshire or here at University of Missouri St. Louis, where many of our courses are also administered online, that is neither massive nor open. It is a closed course that requires registration and usually permission of the instructor. It usually has a maximum of 20 or 30 students in it, and there is a tremendous amount of interaction between the professor and the students, whether that be in online chats or even on the phone. And so I don't think online education is necessarily doomed. I think that it's a rising tide that we can't avoid. But there's a big, huge difference between online education and massive open online education. And the fact is that any education that is at all effective is not going to be free. Someone is going to have to pay for it because it requires an educator who is dedicated to those specific students.
Which makes it even more interesting that the new model for Udacity is going to be in corporate training. So obviously there's some money to be made there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's possible that that may work quite well for them. It will still probably have a large attrition rate. Most MOOCs have between a 90 and a 93% attrition rate. But in the corporate world, I don't know if that is even going to be an issue. The MOOCs primary demographic, over 80% of students enrolled in MOOCs are older adults who have a degree already. Many have advanced degrees already. And so the MOOC demographic is lifetime learners who are doing it as a hobby. And it may very well be that MOOCs will succeed for the rest of time as continuing education, but that does not make them the dramatically democratizing force of free knowledge that the Tom Friedmans of the world assumed that they would be.
You teach at a big university. You're aware of these huge lecture classes where students are absolutely not paying attention. But, you know, the cost of education is going up. The value of secondary school education is really being questioned vis-a-vis the cost. What is the solution here? Is something like MOOCs going to work? What are you looking at for disrupting education the way that it's going, as a lot of people are calling for?
It's absolutely true. The current state of higher education in the United States is really troubling, and the main problem is corporatization. We have a growing administration in most universities and a shrinking faculty, and especially a shrinking full-time faculty. The vast majority of college faculty in the United States today is adjuncts like me, who are paid on semester-to-semester contracts and much, much less than you would ever imagine a college professor being paid. I'd like to think that I provide a quality product, quality education to my students, but if I were full-time, I would probably be better. So there's absolutely something that needs to be done. And I think that hybrid online in-person models, they have a lot of potential. And even online models that are neither massive nor open have a lot of potential. There has been some research done in recent years that shows that the sticker price of college has been artificially inflated to make it look like more of a luxury prestige good. And so I think some regulation on that end would be important as well.
Now that's something to follow up on. And Rebecca, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Rebecca Schumann, education columnist for Slate, where she wrote about the king of MOOCs abdicating his throne. You'll find a link to read that article and more at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you for spending some time with us today. We do invite you to share what you heard with others. You can go to wordofmouthradio.org for a deep catalog of conversations to listen to post on social media, or to email on to your friends. We find that the best stories tend to bounce around by word of mouth. Let's keep on sharing them. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Bill Berry,
and Zach Nugent.
Our intern is
James Pouliot.
Digital support from Rebecca Lavoie
and Sarah Plord.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcasts and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook and Tumblr at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth
is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.